And Dorothee will tell us a little bit about how multi-level governance can help in the response to COVID. She's head of unit decentralization, public investment, and sub-national finance. And much of her work is focused on multi-level governance. This year, she has been leading the assessment of territorial impacts of the COVID crisis across different regions within OECD countries. And she has been reviewing the multi-level governance responses to address the COVID crisis. So, Dorothee, without further ado, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. So I would like to thank PBL and Mark Thiessen for inviting me in this very interesting What Works school. So I'm speaking from Paris, from the OECD. There is a bit of noise in the building today, so I hope that there won't be too much trouble. But I will present indeed the findings of our paper, of our work on the territorial impact of the COVID-19 crisis, managing the crisis across levels of government. The last version of the paper was released in November. It's available on our website. So the key issues, so I will upload the slide. I will share the screen now. Can you see it? Okay. So the key issue of your 2 days is how to stimulate well-being in region and how to implement well-being objectives in practice. So of course, the COVID-19 crisis has challenged well-being of citizens in pretty much all countries, all regions of the world. But what we will see in this presentation is that the crisis has not affected all the countries in the same way, but also all the regions within countries, and that effective multi-level governance has been a critical element in the response. We will also discuss some of the long-term implications of the crisis for multi-level governance and for regional development policy as a whole. So, we need to keep in mind that government around the world at all levels, national, regional, local, are operating in a context of radical uncertainty and that they have to manage multiple crises at once. The health crisis, of course, the economic crisis, which is at the global level the most important crisis, economic crisis since the Second World War, the very important social crisis with a massive increase in disparities, fiscal crisis, etc. So it's a very, very complex context, and the crisis is not linear, contrary to previous crises in which there was a big shock and then there was the recovery. This crisis is not linear because there are several shocks happening over time, and there is a great uncertainty on the next steps. But what we analyze in the paper is the territorial impact of the crisis. And this territorial impact in municipalities and regions has been very important for two reasons. The first one is that simply that municipalities and regions are at the front line of managing the crisis. In many countries, they are responsible with various degrees, of course, depending on the decentralization context, but they are responsible for critical aspects of social services, healthcare, utility services, local economic development, public investment, and so on. So even when they do not necessarily have the responsibility in the health sectors, like in France, for example, some national governments have still been highly exposed to manage the urgency. And above all, they have many responsibilities linked to the protection of vulnerable population, all of which are the most affected by the pandemic, either directly or indirectly. The second reason of this territorial impact is that within countries, the pandemic has hit some regions and cities harder than others. And this is true from all the different dimensions of the crisis, the health, the economic, the social, the fiscal crisis. And the maps of the various impacts do not necessarily coincide. So if we start with the health impact to show a bit the differences within countries, you can see on the right the disparities in the number of COVID-19 fatalities within countries. So in some countries like Italy, Mexico, the United States, or the United Kingdom, for example, the disparities within countries have been particularly large. In the Netherlands, regional disparities were smaller than in other countries, but still significant. And the region with the highest number of fatalities has concentrated 25% of all the country cases. So a number of factors explain these very important territorial disparities. These include, to mention a few, of course, the way the first clusters developed in the country, because this has had a strong impact on the pandemic. But urban density is also an important factor. Clearly, large cities have been strongly hit. Some Mexico City concentrates more than 15% of Mexico fatalities. In Sweden, Stockholm concentrates 40%. And in Santiago in Chile, it's 73% of fatalities related to COVID-19 are concentrated in the capital city. But density per se is not necessarily a problem, because we also see some very dense cities in Asia, like Hong Kong, Tokyo, Seoul, Singapore, which has limited the spread of the virus with very proactive measures. So it is really when density is associated with the lack of appropriate measures and poor housing conditions, crowded housing conditions, and limited access to healthcare, that the situation gets really worse. And it's very clear that within large urban areas, we observe that it is the deprived urban areas which are the most strongly hit. For example, the Bronx in New York has been the most strongly hit area, the Seine-Saint-Denis in Paris, Île-de-France, the poorest neighborhoods of London have been more affected. So there is a very clear correlation here. The access to hospital beds is, of course, a critical factor to in the mitigation of the crisis. And here we have a map. And here what we know is that the remote rural regions have lost over the past two decades a number of hospital beds. They have lost, actually, for 1,000 inhabitants, they have lost 22%. There has been a 22% decrease in the number of hospital beds in remote rural regions. So metropolitan regions are better equipped. This map shows the disparities in the access to hospital beds across countries. So you can see the huge disparities with some countries like Mexico or the US, which have less hospital beds compared to Germany or Korea, for example. But you can see also that within countries, there are some disparities. For example, in the US, in Turkey, in Poland, just to take a few examples. Overall, what we observe is that there has been a 6% excess in mortality in all OECD regions in this year, for the first semester 2020, compared to the previous 2 years, a 6% of excess in mortality. But again, there are very strong differences because, for example, for the large metropolitan regions, it's 13% in excess of mortality, and it's 3% in the remote regions. But this is for the first semester, so the first wave, let's say, of the crisis. But now that we have, unfortunately, second or even third wave in some countries, we can see that the impact has been a bit more diffused in some countries, a bit more diffused to not only to large cities, but also to less populated regions. For example, in the US, the highest increase in the number of deaths occurring in October was in the rural counties, not adjacent to metropolitan areas. So the health impact is differentiated, but the economic, fiscal impact are also differentiated. So I will just provide two illustrations. So for the economic impact, it varies across regions, and it depends. This impact depends on the exposure of regions to global value chain, the sectoral specialization. For example, tourism, of course, has been very strongly affected. So touristic regions are at higher risk of job disruption than other regions. In a region like the Greek region of South Aegean, they have 40%, they have almost half of their jobs, which is at risk in the current context, but especially with the lockdown. So this map on the screen shows the share of jobs potentially at risk with the confinement measures in the first semester of this year. So one way to mitigate this very strong economic impact of the crisis is remote working, is the ability to do remote working, as most of us do at the moment. But this capacity to do remote working is not evenly distributed across territories. Some territories have more capacities to do that than others, and here, again, we can see a kind of an urban-rural gap. It's clear that urban populations have a significantly higher potential to telework than those in rural areas. In Europe, if we just take Europe, the share of jobs potentially performed at home is 13 percentage points higher in cities than in rural areas. So even if large cities have been very, very strongly affected by the health and the economic impact of the crisis, they also have a better resilience to mitigate this impact with the remote working. And the last type of impact that I would like to mention is the impact on the fiscal impact, the impact on subnational finance, the finance of regional and local government. So all subnational governments in the OECD have been very strongly impacted by the crisis, but again, some more than others, depending on their responsibilities, on the structure of their revenues, their sensitivity to economic fluctuation, etc. So it's clear, for example, that countries like the US or Sweden, in which local governments rely heavily on tax, are more affected in the short term than other countries. So we conducted a joint survey with the European Committee of the Region across more than 300 local and regional governments, looking at the impact of the crisis on some national governments. So the slide the chart that you can see is one of the results of this survey. So it shows that for 90% of subnational governments surveyed in the European Union, they consider that they will have a decrease in revenue in this year 2020. And for 61%, they expect this impact to be higher. So they expect, in particular, the decrease in tax revenue and user charges and fees. And this is particularly the case for large cities. But they also expect a huge impact on spending, expenditure. So 86% expect an impact on spending, with in particular spending for social benefits, support to vulnerable populations, support to SMEs. And 45% of them say that they anticipate a very high negative impact on spending. So this is the diagnosis, a bit complicated, very complicated situation. So what are the risks? The risks are to have a scissor effect with an increase in expenditure, a decline in revenue, which could lead then to increased deficit and debt. And fiscal consolidation plans, if they are implemented in the medium term, could of course lead to cuts in public investment or social expenditure, which could affect even more a vulnerable population. For regional economies, the risk, there are multiple risks at the moment. The risks are for them not to be able to participate in recovery plans if they don't have the fiscal capacity to contribute. So the risks are also to focus very much on the short-term priorities and not on resilience and the long-term priorities that we will discuss in following part of the presentation, and the risks are really to amplify the pre-existing trends and to increase regional disparities. After the 2008 crisis in the OECD, it has been an important trend that there has been an increase in the disparities among, in particular, metropolitan areas and the rest of the territories, which contain multiple risks and what we call sometimes the geography of discontent and the increase in populism. So this is really something that should be watched carefully, and this is a very important risk of this COVID, the consequences of this COVID-19 crisis. So let me now turn to the policy responses. So addressing this differentiated impact requires designing policy response with a place-based approach to address these various dimensions. But there are a number of priorities that countries have put in place to respond to the crisis. And this is a bit the good news in this very challenging context, is that countries, governments around the world in the OECD have reacted quickly, massively, and at all levels of government. And the national government have reacted very strongly, but regional and local government have also adopted many proactive measures in this context. So in the paper, we identified six priorities for managing the territorial impact of the crisis. So it's a territorial approach to the health crisis, to the economic crisis, the upscale in digital tools to track the pandemic, of course, to accelerate the digitalization of local public services, to support some national finance and public investment recovery strategies. So I will not mention all these different categories, but just provide a few selected examples. So on the health front, it's clear that managing the crisis requires a degree of flexibility to allow for differentiated territorial responses to minimize also the cost of national confinement, which are huge and really should be used as the extreme measure when the pandemic is too widespread and cannot be controlled underground. So a number of countries have implemented localized policies for lockdowns, a mask, a school closure, restaurant closures, etc. On the economic front, so government have really implemented large recovery packages, much larger than in 2008. For regional policy, many countries and the European Union have redirected funding to crisis priorities to support regions strongly hit by the crisis, healthcare, SMEs and the self-employed and vulnerable population. In the EU, the EU has strongly mobilized cohesion policy and has modified the rules that apply to European structural and investment funds. So more than 100 programs were changed to respond to the COVID-19 crisis. So this was not the case after the 2008 crisis. So this is very positive. And the last generation of national recovery packages implemented by OECD countries have tend to have a more explicit territorial dimension. For example, in Canada, in France, in Germany, there is a specific support to specific regions and municipalities the most affected. And the countries have also been very active to support some national finance. So 2/3 of OECD countries have adopted measures to support some national government finance, either on the revenue side, on the expenditure side, or they have relaxed fiscal rules in Mexico, in Denmark, in Korea, for example. And in the first phase, they have really focused on supporting SMEs, vulnerable population, firms in general. In the second phase, they are focusing more, they are introducing more the public and investment dimension in the recovery strategy, so to build back better and to really focus on the on some of the long-term priorities. So there are three priorities in the OECD investment recovery strategies that we observe in many countries. The first is the strengthening the health systems. Second is the digitalization. And third, the acceleration to of the transition to a climate, to a carbon neutral economy. So for this public investment recovery strategy, a message that, that we have in this paper is that it's really important for them to have a territorial dimension. And also it's important for some national government to be involved early on in the implementation. And here we come back to this question of governance, because indeed to be successful, the recovery strategy and the response to the crisis and the place-based response to the crisis need require effective multi-level governance, coordination across levels of government, across jurisdiction, with citizens and private actors. So this is, we will now shift to this part. And it's a very easy to mention the need for this coordination, but the crisis has also shown that it's difficult in practice. And a number of countries have met different obstacles and challenges in this coordination of the crisis response. So we will go through these challenges. And but before doing that, I would like to do a quick poll that we to ask you that for you, what have been the main challenges faced by your country in the link to multi-level governance, in the management linked to the management of this crisis, and we will be able to compare to the to OECD responses, because we conducted the same. The same poll in a meeting recently with 32 OECD countries. So it would be just interesting to see what you think. So we have six types of responses. I hope that you can see them well on the slide. So on the responsibility is not clearly defined, insufficient vertical coordination, horizontal coordination, coordination across borders, insufficient resources, or Okay, so I don't know if we are. If we are done.
Just
okay,
quickly,
so it's okay.
Very quickly, you have still about, well, a thick 5 minutes, let's say, 7 minutes or so. Is that okay? Or do you need a little bit more time?
Maybe 15.
Okay,
if that's okay.
10 then, if that's okay for you, so that we have enough time for the Q&A.
Sorry? Yeah.
If it's okay, we make it 10 minutes and then we have enough time for the Q&A. Following.
Okay, this. We'll try. We'll try. Okay, so this is interesting. So 25, so the highest number is the insufficient vertical coordination. Then the fact that responsibilities are not clearly defined, the lack of coordination across borders, the insufficient resources, and insufficient horizontal cooperation across jurisdiction. And the least category is the excessive administrative burden to rapidly mobilize these resources. Okay, well, that's very interesting. So maybe if we can put back the slide. Okay, can you see it? It's okay. Okay, so you see that it's pretty consistent with OECD countries, although we can see some differences. For on average, for OECD countries, the lack of the insufficient resources at the subnational level in the poll that we conducted was reported as the first obstacle, but then insufficient vertical coordination among levels of government followed quite closely, and also the fact that responsibilities may not be clearly defined across levels of government. So we see that these are consistent challenges across countries and in the Netherlands as well. If we focus a bit more on the coordination challenges, we can see that the coordination, so across levels of government, was very prominent, but also the lack of cross-border cooperation was reported as a major challenge for OECD countries, and also the challenging cooperation between some national government and other stakeholders like NGOs, social partners, business, etc. So, coordination, why is coordination so important? Because responsibilities in all the areas linked to the crisis management, they are shared across levels of government. So by definition, there is a mutual dependency which requires coordination. The externalities of this virus are so high that not a single jurisdiction can manage it on its own. At the risk of non-coordinating is to pass the buck to other level of government to compete for supplies, and we have seen that in a number of countries. In the recovery, it's to implement disjointed recovery strategies, uncoordinated with conflicted objectives, etc. So it's all the dimensions of vertical coordination, so the intermunicipal cooperation, interregional cooperation, the cross-border, the cooperation with the public and private stakeholders is critical. So what we saw is that we did a survey at the national level with in OECD countries, and we found that 9 out of 17 countries have mobilized existing mechanisms and created new ones, and 7 countries have mobilized existing mechanisms. So it's clear that having in place some institutions, some platforms of dialogue which can facilitate this coordination, the countries which had them in place and which had some experience in mobilizing them, had a comparative advantage in the management of the crisis. So we have a number of examples of vertical coordination across levels of government, horizontal coordination across municipalities and regions. I will maybe just take one example. So in Korea, for example, they adopted a whole of government approach to manage the crisis, with the prime minister chairing the Central Crisis Management Committee, where the relevant ministries, the provinces, and the major cities are represented. But there are a lot of other examples than Korea, but for time reason, I will just mention this one. On the horizontal coordination, there have been many, many initiatives taken by some national government to cooperate with their neighboring jurisdiction and to provide joint responses. So just to take one example, in the United States, given that at the federal level that there was not so much a coordinated response, the governors of New York and New Jersey, Connecticut have established a common set of guidelines on social distancing, and they have cooperated in their responses. So in the survey that we conducted with the Committee of the Regions, when we ask what are the most important dimensions for the exit strategy and the recovery, this coordination dimension came out as the first, the most important criteria for 90% of respondents. But additional resources for some national government, the communication with the public, the possibility to adapt the measures to the local situation, the involvement of the private actor and the civil society also came up very high. A very important dimension to mention is this communication to the public at all levels of government. Communicating a clear and coherent message, both for citizens and for some national government. We saw in a number of countries when some national government were not involved, it has raised to strong opposition to the measures taken by the national level. And we can also see an interesting correlation that you can see on this chart between the level of trust in government in the country and the health outcomes. And there seems to be a positive correlation. So in countries with relatively low levels of trust, it seems that the compliance maybe to the measures was less important that in countries with high level of trust. So that could be an explanation. So for to manage the next steps of this crisis, strengthening this trust, transparency, communication with the citizens and with the different stakeholders involved is critical. So the implications for multi-level governance in the long term to build more resilient system, if we try to draw some preliminary lessons. We need national coherence in the response, but combined with the flexibility and the autonomy for local authorities to take initiatives, and with effective coordination across levels of government. And a very important point is that the responsibilities should be assigned in a clear way, in a very clear way. And on that dimension, we have noticed many, many challenges in OECD countries. So what we can say is that it's not the degree of centralization or decentralization that matters, because there have been many debates around that in the crisis. It's not the degree itself that matters. It's really the way coordination mechanisms have been mobilized with sufficient flexibility, and that made the difference in a number of countries. So the crisis is also highlighting the importance of this clarity in the assignment, but also the fact that not all some national government at the same level of government, so the regional level, the municipal, the intermunicipal, may necessarily need to have the same responsibilities. It can depend a bit on their capacities. And for example, it's pretty clear that metropolitan areas, metropolitan regions need to have differentiated responsibilities compared to other regions. So this is also something to consider when rethinking multi-level governance systems. And an important point, of course, is to have crisis management, risk management strategies in place at all levels of government. We saw that Asian countries like Korea and Japan, which had to manage the stress crisis, they had crisis risk management strategies in all jurisdictions at all levels of government, and they were really ready to react very quickly. So this having this risk management strategy in place to be able to cope with the future crisis will be essential. So the last part, the final part of the presentation is really to look a bit more, even more forward-looking and the broader implications of this crisis for regional development policy and well-being. So you know it, I think, at the OECD, we have a well-being regional framework at the regional level with 11 dimensions. So for quite a few years, the OECD has really promoted the need to go beyond GDP, beyond the traditional criteria linked to growth and productivity, and to focus really on this 11 dimension as the core metrics for regional well-being. So they include dimensions like environment, health, income, jobs, education, life satisfaction, etc. So of course, the crisis will have an impact on all of these dimensions in pretty much all regions of the world. But what we can already see is that many regions are rethinking regional policy objectives in the wake of this crisis, and some of the priorities that clearly emerge are the need to focus on really health as a core priority. So to focus on foundational sectors such as health, social care, basic infrastructure. So in a way to go back to the basics, which may have been a bit forgotten in recent years and that are integral to local economies. So it was interesting to see in our survey in the European Union that the first response in the priorities post-COVID crisis are for 76% of respondents, the fact that regional development strategies should place more emphasis on accessing quality public services, notably health. And in health, indeed, we can see this is from the regional well-being index, the health indicator. We can see huge disparities, not only across countries, but within countries, so in the life expectancy and the health outcomes. Another kind of post-COVID implication is what we call the new spatial equilibrium. So what does it mean? The new normal may imply a significant increase in remote working as the entire world has had to shift to digital tools in just a few months. And this will not stop after the COVID crisis. That this will be a potential game changer for the spatial equilibrium between urban and rural areas. So medium-sized cities may gain traction in some countries or rural areas. So this has strong potential implications for long-term regional development. But of course, the scale of this change is very hard to anticipate because some people choose to live in cities not just for work, but also for the amenities they can find here. So it's very hard to anticipate the shift, and it's possible that the shift be quite limited in that. So these are just some possible scenarios for the future which have strong implications for regional development policy. And of course, the shift in this urban-rural linkages will also depend very much on the digital transition, and here we already saw that there are huge gaps between urban and rural areas in the access to high quality internet. So in the OECD, on average, it's 85% of urban households who have access to high quality internet compared to 56% of the rural household. And given the very tight fiscal context, it's unclear how to finance the massive investment that are needed to upscale really the digital access in rural areas. So another post-COVID-19 implication for regional development is, of course, the focus on climate. It has been again mentioned by the UN this morning, the need to have much greener recovery strategies post-COVID-19. So on a positive side, we can say that the crisis has been a kind of has revealed the imperative to focus in a much stronger way on these objectives. And here, the role of regional and local government is critical, given that they are in charge on average in the OECD for 64% of public investment linked to climate and environment objectives. So there are many opportunities linked to circular economy, et cetera, that should be put in place. But it's true that in the recovery strategies, we can see that countries have focused a lot more on climate priorities compared to the 2008 crisis. But still, it has been estimated by the OECD that around half of the policy support in recovery packages is still going to burn fossil fuels. So opportunities and challenges. And the last implication is really linked to globalization and what it means for territories and regions and local areas. The COVID crisis questions the way globalization works and calls for greater resilience in global value chains. Local production processes are more sustainable, which is increasingly important for consumers. So there may be a movement of reshoring certain activities. But here again, there are opportunities, there are challenges. Many tasks are difficult to relocate as they depend on local resources or specific skills. And also the production lines cannot be changed too quickly. And they are often built for 7 to 9 years, for example. So these are just a few possible long-term implications, but I will be happy to get your views and respond to your question. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks so much, Dorothee, for that elaborate sketch of the impact of COVID on regional level and sketching some of these specific challenges and solutions in terms of multi-level governance. I just forgot about giving you a heads up that your time was finished because it just got more interesting with each slide. So that means we have less time for the Q&A now. Let's say a thick 10 minutes. I already saw some questions in the chat, so I'm going to give people that post their question in the chat the floor in a minute. But if you have additional questions, then please just put them down in the chat and I'll be happy to give you the floor. Let's start off with Anne-Marie Hitpu. I pronounced that correctly. Please, can you highlight your question?
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you very much for your presentation, Dorothee. Very interesting. And the question that I had was about a topic that you raised about the digital divide. We see that I am Chief Resilience Officer for the City of The Hague, and this digital divide is really a very difficult problem to tackle, but a very important one as we see. But have you seen cities, countries that really are active on overcoming this problem?
Yes, so what we for many countries and local government, it has been this crisis has revealed the digital divide that perhaps was not so prominent before. And it's true that we see that in the responses in a number of countries, this is a top priorities. So, for example, in France or in Italy, the response to the digital divide is one of the most important items. So now we will have to see on the implementation side if it's really put in practice in the coming months. But apart, these are for the responses at the national level. At the local level, we also saw that a number of local governments were very reactive in quickly mobilizing digital tools to respond to the crisis. So in Milan, for example, in the city of Rennes, in France, they have really set up, you know, some use the digital tools to communicate with citizens, to actively involve them, etc. The crisis will probably massively accelerate the move to the smart city movement. But this is too early to assess because there are local government and national government are still in really managing the crisis. So what we can assess at this stage is the extent to which they put that as a priority in the response. But it will take a bit of time to really see how this is implemented on the ground. But it's true that this smart city dynamic, which had started before, but is now really amplified with the responses to the crisis.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think what we as a government see is that we do a lot ourselves to try to reach people that do not have these digital skills, but it's very hard in these times to train people to get the skills to be part of this digital transformation that we're going through at the moment. And especially more vulnerable people are hard to train and give these skills. But thank you very much.
No, absolutely. And this is a key point. Because in the investment recovery strategy, the focus should not just be on investing in high quality internet and broadband. It should be very much in investing in the skills that go with it in the regions. And that's why it needs to be territorially based, because we know that the needs, the skills need depend largely, vary a lot across regions. And these skills, this soft dimension, I would say, of the infrastructure investment response in digital is as important as the investment in the core broadband things, etc. So it's very important to see that in complementarity, and this is very important.
Yeah. So not a one size fits all, and a focus on capabilities. And not just on the technologies, I believe.
Yes.
Thanks for that response, Dorothee. Let's jump to the next question, Monique Rosso. Monique, can you maybe highlight your question?
Well, it wasn't actually a question. It was an addition to the answer.
Yeah.
That until recently, the concept of smart cities, at least in the Netherlands, was very much confined to technologically smart cities. And actually, we have to change. We have to socially smart cities. And when looking at broad welfare and the matching of policy goals, I think that's a challenge. That will be a challenge.
Yeah, thanks for the additional point.
I agree.
Wijnand van Smalen, can you please highlight your question?
Yes, so you said something about regional governments changing their policies. We have some examples of also including more aspects of welfare or well-being.
So this was This was the response of the survey that we did in the European Union. So far we have not conducted specific studies on specific regions. So, but this was the aggregate response of the 300 regions and cities that participate in the survey. And they have highlighted, so I think it was 73% shifted to focus, plan to shift, because given that the crisis was in the middle of the year, it's more for the next year and the next budget, etc. But to shift to focus more on health priorities, on digital priorities, and the transition to a low carbon economy, and the building more resilient regions. I think these were the four categories of answer that came out first. But it's true that this provides a kind of snapshot of what they intend to do. But again, now we will need to see how it's implemented in practice. And it's only in 2 to 3 years time that we'll be able to fully assess whether there has been, well, first the full impact on regional well-being index, because there is a 2 years lag in the data that we have. So we will be able to evaluate fully in 2022 and to see how indeed at the regional and at the local government, they have shifted their priorities or not. But I'm sure we can find examples of regions which have already implemented. It's 1/3 of the regions in the European Union which have implemented specific public investment measures focusing on the long-term priorities. So it's still a minority of regions.
Okay, thanks Wijnand for your question. Let's jump to the last two questions on the list. Mark Thyssen, maybe you can highlight your question briefly.
Dorothy, thank you very much for a very nice presentation and raising all these issues. And one of the main issues that seemed to come forward was like, how do you coordinate policy between regions and between national government and the regions? And so I was thinking, do you have some international examples of good practices in this respect? Maybe some practices that came because of the COVID crisis at the moment, and how to handle these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. So I didn't have the time to go through the slide on coordination, but this is complicated because indeed, as you said, coordination is in itself complicated and takes time. There are transaction costs. It's costly to coordinate. So there needs to be a kind of in between and to find the right balance. But what is clear is that when subnational governments are not involved at all and discover, like in the media 1 hour before, that there is a measure from the national government that will affect their territory and that they are not involved, that's not at all an ideal scenario, because then you reach a stage of conflict in which subnational authorities do not want to comply with the measures, and so citizens as well. And we have seen that in quite a few countries. I mean, there are really examples of conflicts between the subnational and the national government. So the right balance is difficult to find, and it depends also very much on whether these mechanisms existed before and whether it's government are really used to mobilize them, or whether they have had to be created in the middle of the crisis. So, for example, in countries like Canada or Australia, they have strong platforms, mechanisms of coordination, so it was relatively easy in the crisis context to mobilize them and to reach kind of consensus in the response. In Korea, they also have some mechanisms linked to crisis management, and in Japan as well. But in Korea, they have reform a bit the mechanisms in the crisis during this COVID crisis to involve even more to provide an even more whole of government response. So involving a really local authorities, the provinces in the response. And there have been, so the type of successful mechanism is the one that would, for example, meet on a weekly basis. So it's not something that should be too heavy, but there should be this consultation so that the some national government do not discover ex post some measures that concern them. But at the same time, this is true for centralized countries and for decentralized countries. And being a centralized country does not mean that you will have automatically a good coordination. Not at all. We have examples of centralized countries with very poor coordinations.
We can look east, Dorothy. I hear you say as well. These countries that had rehearsals already with previous crises and have developed this more multi-level, one government approach, they may well serve as interesting examples to look at. Unfortunately, we do not have the time anymore to go into the other questions that are on the list, which are at least as interesting as the questions that have come before. So I'm sorry, Saskia, Matthijs, maybe we have some room for those questions later on. But now let me thank Dorothy for your great talk and